some of these common processes going on in all of these donor agencies, where you're having the selective uptake of these global agendas, which leads to the appearance of maybe an emerging consensus, but that the implementation of it will maybe vary considerably depending on a range of factors domestically.
You are listening to In Pursuit of Development with Dan Banik.
Why do aid agencies from wealthy donor countries with diverse domestic, political, and economic contexts arrive at very similar positions on certain foreign aid policies and priorities? In his book, The Globalization of Foreign Aid: Developing Consensus, my guest examines how certain ideas and practices influence the work of aid agencies in Canada, the United States, and Sweden, and how aid agencies end up adopting common policy priorities in the fields of gender and security. He argues that the so-called emerging global consensus that constitutes the globalization of aid can be explained by both macro-level globalizing influences as well as micro-level social processes that take place within aid agencies. Liam Swiss is an associate professor of sociology at Memorial University of Newfoundland in Canada. We discuss the evolution of the concept of foreign aid or development assistance, what motivates wealthy donor countries to actually provide aid, the influence of international conferences and major global events on the aid policies of donor countries, and the role of individual agency, including that of bureaucratic activism and bureaucratic entrepreneurialism. I hope you enjoy our conversation. I've been highly impressed with your scholarship, Liam, and I've particularly enjoyed reading your work over the years, the work that is particularly related to foreign aid. So I'm really delighted to have you on the show. Welcome.
Thanks, Dan. Thanks for having me. I look forward to chatting with you today.
So let's begin with the concept of foreign aid, or this animal that is called aid, Liam, because there's often this confusion as to what it is and what it is not. And some would, of course, say this is too complex. There are all kinds of different so-called aid worlds. We're talking about official development aid or ODA. And we're talking about development aid provided through or by NGOs and civil society organizations. And then there's all of this humanitarian and emergency aid by official donors, UN agencies, NGOs, Red Cross. And even though there's been historically a lot of focus on official development assistance, not everybody seems to be on board in terms of what aid is. So could you take us through the, if you can, the evolution of the concept of foreign aid or development assistance, which is often the term that is used these days, and how you think understandings of this concept has changed over the years and what it means today?
It's a big question, Dan, but I'll try to do it justice. I think from my perspective as a sociologist studying foreign aid, but as someone who worked in the foreign aid field for the Canadian International Development Agency for a couple of years, aid to me for a long time had been very much pigeonholed in our analytic and intellectual understanding as simply a financial transfer. And I think if you look at a lot of the foreign aid research literature, there's been a lot of focus just on that question. And as somebody who does a mix of quantitative and qualitative research on the subject, I think it's very easy to kind of just focus on the money, look at where and how the money flows and what that buys. But I think in my mind, there's a bigger piece that we need to consider beyond that money. And so I don't know if it's a truly an evolution in terms of how aid is being perceived over time, because I think maybe it's always done some of this, but I do think that it requires us to go beyond just thinking of official development assistance as a transfer of money from A to B, and that's the be all and the end all of that. So it's in more recent years, I think there's a need to understand not just how and where that money flows, but what that does, what ideas, what discourses, what policies and institutions are part and parcel of that. And so in the big picture now, I think that, you know, from one perspective, you can think about aid resources being about, you know, trying to help various communities, societies, groups, etc., to achieve their immediate aims and objectives in terms of improving people's lives and well-being, in terms of responding to humanitarian crises or long-term and necessary institutional reforms. But it is important to realize that I think a big part of that is about the relationships it builds and the connections that it builds in the global context. So my research in this area has largely kind of tried to focus on aid as both existing within and also building perhaps connections within a broader world society, such that we think of aid not just as this financial transfer, but as something that kind of builds relationships and ties that can lead to these reforms and developments going forward. Obviously, you know, there's so much more we can talk about here in terms of power imbalances and all of the various problems that have been associated and identified with aid and development discourse over time. And I don't want to lose sight of that. But from my perspective, I think I see over time this, you know, broader understanding of aid and all its multiplicities kind of emerge in the research context. I think within donor agencies themselves, they realize that aid is much more than just this financial transfer that it might have once used to have been perceived as, but that in all of that, it's a transnational process that is rife with politics, power, and the ability to kind of sustain change, I think, and to, you know, work to, you know, move processes of change. And that might not always be change for the better. And I think you can look at the history of aid and see all sorts of evidence of missteps and unintended consequences and whatnot. But
yeah, you know, I was thinking, Liam, about also the fact that maybe it isn't, well, some would say it isn't even politically correct to use the term aid anymore. And some say it's development assistance. A lot of emerging countries avoid using the term aid. It would be perhaps much more convenient to say investments or, you know, solidarity. I don't know. So,
no, I think that's a really valid point, right? You know, obviously.
So is it being politically incorrect to say that it is foreign aid that we're talking about?
I don't know if I'd go so far to say it's politically incorrect to say it, but I think just because it has been a common parlance to discuss it in those terms. So I think people recognize that as a catch-all for that process. But I think when it comes down to it, there is maybe some loaded baggage that comes with the term aid and this notion of helping, when in actual fact, I think if you look across a lot of contexts now, it is much more one of partnership or solidarity or assistance, as you point out. So it might be a sloppy shorthand for all of that parcel of relationships and transfers and collaboration that does take place in that space. So yeah, you know, I could be convinced of that. I do, you know, I don't want to get lost in kind of debating the minutiae of different terms like that, but you're right. I think there's a case to be made that there's something patronizing about the term aid versus some of these other ways that we might refer to it. Whether if you're talking to people outside of the field of study that they recognize that that's what you're talking about, if you're not calling it aid, might be a another thing.
Right.
You know, here in Canada, there's a common sort of adage when you're talking to academics and policymakers and politicians and whatnot, and they ask you if it passes the TIMSS test. And Tim Hortons is this very popular, unexplainedly so popular, coffee and donut shop here in Canada. And the TIMSS test is whether or not what you're talking about would actually ring true to, you know, your average neighborhood grandmother down the corner at Tim's or whatever, right? So I do think that question of what do people recognize as that thing or that constellation of things that has been called foreign aid is still an important thing to ask.
So let's move on to understanding the motivations behind aid. There's been considerable academic interest in trying to better understand what actually motivates donor countries, donor states, to provide aid. And one dominant explanation is, of course, some would say it's altruism, that there are humanitarian concerns based on the extent and degree of global poverty, inequality, some sort of need. And some would say it's also this recognition in donor countries that, you know, we are lucky, you know, we won the lottery, as we say in Norway, and others may not have been as lucky. And so we have some sort of moral obligation to help. And another set of major explanations is, of course, related to the national interest. And we see this much more now in countries like the UK. And you know how aid agencies there have been affected, at least DFID has been affected. There's been a lot of focus on the national interest that by providing some form of assistance, a donor state expects to achieve some goal. It could be political ideology, foreign policy, commercial interests, security, in addition to perhaps also economic development. And then you have, you know, smaller countries like Norway and also Sweden that I know you've studied, where, you know, it is more perhaps a bit about soft power, branding. So what are your thoughts there in terms of the motivations behind foreign aid as you see them today?
I think you kind of capture kind of the two prevailing and contrasting motivations that are often talked about there, right? Is this some sort of form of humanitarian or solidaristic support of fighting poverty and improving people's well-being and whatnot versus that sort of national self-interest in a whole range of different fields or sectors, like you say, security, investment, other commercial interests. And, you know, I think us academics have had a tendency to focus a bit on, you know, contrasting and categorizing these motivations and trying to fit different donor countries in different boxes or along different spectrums when it comes to this sort of spectrum from more altruistic to more self-interested. And I think to some extent that's not that helpful, because I am convinced that in all development assistance, we can see aspects of both motivations. Not, you know, arguably you can find ideal types or specific examples that are maybe more purely self-interested or more purely altruistic. But if you look at the approach to development assistance or aid of any given donor country, I think it won't be hard to find some examples within that of both motivations coexisting, feeding into one another, and being wielded by politicians and interested actors within the development assistance industry to justify or rationalize their actions at a given point in time. So my assessment, at least now, is that it, as much as we might, you know, slot certain countries at different points on that spectrum, I don't think there is such a thing as a purely altruistic donor, and I don't think there's such a thing as a purely self-interested donor when it comes to development assistance. And a bigger question that I've been interested to look at, and I've done a bit of work with a colleague from the UK, Nilima Gorajani at Overseas Development Institute, this bigger question of why, given these motivations, do new countries want to become donors? And what is it about that motivation that exists? And I think one of the things that I find quite interesting as a motivation, which would, you know, be part of self-interest because it is a reputational concern, but there is, you know, seemingly this prevailing expectation that states, when they reach a certain level of power or importance globally, that they're expected to have some form of development assistance mechanism or agency. And, you know, obviously we see the emergence of different ways of providing development assistance or cooperation among a whole range of different countries now, beyond kind of the conventional Western industrialized high-income DAC donor countries, that I think is troubling to just fit into a national self-interest mold, that there is this sort of reputational or legitimacy-oriented motive there that maybe wasn't as present early on in the growth and evolution of development assistance as an international institution. But even in that, I think there is still both an overlapping, coexisting sort of aspect of altruistic motives linked with national self-interest motives. So it's I'm always puzzled by it, and it's quite interesting to see some of that proliferation of that institution as troubled and as kind of questioned as it has been over the last, you know, 60-70 years, still kind of, you know, taking hold for these various reasons.
I think you're absolutely right about a combination, that there's no real sort of, you can't really say that it is self-interest or humanitarian needs. It's a combination of everything. And I've been studying China, of course, in Africa, and increasingly also now India and Africa. One area I feel that these emerging donors tend to distinguish themselves is by telling recipient countries that, unlike Western donors who never really told you, you know, what their self-interest was, we are pretty open about it. We need, this is more the Chinese case than maybe India. We need this from you. We need either natural resources, or you may not have something now. Maybe you could help us in the future. So it appears to me, Liam, and I'd like to hear your views on this, it appears to me that the emerging donors are, and I've been making this argument, people perhaps are a little tired of hearing me say it so, that the emerging donors sometimes, especially China, are much more sophisticated in their communication of what they expect in return, whereas the typical Western donor tends to couch self-interest, or maybe sometimes doesn't make it very clear what they want back, you know? So that relationship in terms of the donor-recipient relationship becomes a bit more clouded. It isn't clear to the recipient what is it that the donor expects in return, whereas emerging countries often tend to communicate that expectation much more clearly.
Yeah, I'd agree with that, Dan. I think that has seemed to be the case with especially Chinese assistance in large parts of sub-Saharan Africa and beyond. I'm not certain I have an answer about why it has been easier for those donors like China to kind of just be more direct about that, be more direct about what that self-interest aspect of the arrangement is, right? Maybe that is more of a perception of that relationship between China and the partner country as being more of an investment, more of a, you know, something that's going to lead to some sort of mutual benefit. Whereas perhaps in the past, where the origins of development assistance emerged from, there was at least this charade of altruism that was layered on top of everything. And so maybe it was less acceptable for, you know, a donor to say, well, you know, we want to help you build this dam. For instance, Canada did a lot of that, for instance, all over the world. And the thing that's in it for us is that we're actually going to get you to work with our engineering firms, buy our turbines, buy, you know, all of that sort of tied aid sort of commercial benefit that fed back to the donor country. That aspect maybe was perhaps downplayed or less direct. And so the, you know, the publicity of it, the seeming public motivation of it all was really about, you know, helping a country, you know, improve its electrification processes or something like that. But in the grand scheme of things, there was still this, you know, interest there, that commercial interest of the donor seeing its, you know, engineering sector, for instance, develop these ties overseas and things. And I think at least in the first decade of the 2000s and the Paris Agenda for aid effectiveness and the real push for untying and all of these sorts of things, having that sort of specific commercial self-interest built into assistance programs was viewed as at least being less acceptable amongst like the DAC donors or things like that, even though I don't think it ever really stopped. You know, and that even all these claims around untying and everything that were made at the time, I think there's still pretty clear evidence there was a lot of aid flows that were returning back into donor country economies. It was that rhetoric of saying, well, we're trying to lessen that interest, right? But I think appreciate the directness of the Chinese approach or other donors that are kind of more willing to say, this is what's in it for us, right?
Yeah, and I think it also helps that they couch this as a part of South-South cooperation. Yeah. You know, it is much more appealing coming from another country in the South than from the North, where, and again, I think some of the emerging donors tend to not maybe explicitly, but more implicitly make the claim that their assistance is more relevant than, you know, irrelevant Western models. Mm-hmm. That have worked in a totally different context. And, you know, in terms of, say, agriculture, or in terms of whatever problem that you want to solve, that the Chinese, Indian, South Korean example is, or the Brazilian example is more appealing or more relevant for these countries than many of these experiences in the West.
You know, I think that is a really valid argument. And I think that is something that Western donor countries are having to struggle with kind of rationalizing a little bit too, right? Because, you know, I think if you are in a position of being a recipient country government and you looked at, well, where is the relevance here? What are we getting out of this relationship? And what are the expectations in return? If you're gaining insights and expertise and investment from partners that have been in situations much more recently that are close to where you're at, or have dealt with issues that are much more relevant to your economy or your society in that specific matter, then it's hard to see why countries wouldn't want to work with a South-South partner like that over, you know, a donor from the DAC that is maybe also imposing some other conditions on that assistance, whether it's, you know, something to do with human rights or other standards that may not seem to be, you know, directly related to whatever that investment is. So yeah, I definitely, you know, I think it's obviously a preoccupation of some of the more traditional donor countries about this increased competition from so-called emerging donors like China, India, and others. And, you know, I think they have reason to be concerned in some ways, because, you know, it kind of belies some of the real failings of the conventional development assistance system in one way. Not to say that those sorts of investments don't also have their own problems too.
Liam, let's move on to this superb book that you wrote a couple of years ago, The Globalization of Foreign Aid, where you argue that there is considerable donor rhetoric of an emerging consensus, as you put it, and that there is a striking similarity in aid policies among some of these Western donor states. You were, I think, looking mainly at Canada, the United States, and Sweden. What types of similarities are we talking about here in this emerging consensus? Is it in relation to the types of projects that these donors want to support, or does this consensus also apply to, say, the type of domestic institutions in these countries that are in charge of aid policies?
It's a book that took shape over a long period. So I think things have evolved and changed in that context. But, you know, what struck me as interesting in inspiring the study was the fact that when I was a young, straight out of my master's program, sort of naive development officer working for the Canadian International Development Agency, which doesn't even exist anymore, has been absorbed into our Ministry of Foreign Affairs here.
Oh, just like in the UK.
Just like in the UK, just like in Australia. I witnessed a lot of rhetoric pushing Canadian aid policies in certain directions that seemed to be the same sorts of things that other donors were doing in that space, right? And so one of the key things that I noted was this, you know, frequent reference at the time to this use of this term of the emerging global consensus on these issues. And in the context, you know, this is even when the study started, pre-SDGs, but in the MDG context, this notion that there was a groupthink sort of approach to what issues matter in aid and how we go about that. So you could talk about that in terms of aid priorities. So what sorts of things were being funded? Mm-hmm. You could talk about that in terms of aid modalities. So under the Paris agenda and that sort of aid effectiveness approaches that proliferated in that time, you know, how assistance was being delivered. And arguably, like the question you raise, I think you could now fruitfully talk about that in terms of institutional setup, as you suggested, right? You look at, you know, for instance, the Canadian, Australian, and British cases recently of going to this no longer having a standalone aid agency model. That, to me, also speaks to this sort of notion of there being some common models to these things that are that circulate amongst donors and are taken on to greater or lesser extents among donors. So the study really was driven out of this idea that I saw this move towards at least a tacit homogenization of ideas and approaches to certain things. But then as the study progressed, I realized that, you know, what I was interested in was what was driving that and how that could be seen working within the donor country context in terms of the interface of kind of global models that were being institutionalized or adapted to whatever the specific donor context is. And the reality being that even this rhetoric of global consensus was really mediated by a lot of other kind of more micro level processes going on within the donor agency, within domestic governments, that led to maybe a rhetorical commitment to some of these consensus, but not necessarily a practical commitment in terms of what it meant in terms of implementation. So, you know, reading the book, you can see that I took on a theoretical perspective inspired by John Meyer and his colleagues at Stanford with the, you know, sociological institutionalism or the world society approach that I was trying to tease out how we see that global influence mediated by kind of the work of bureaucrats, by the work of other international actors and things like that. So I try to tease that out through the book, looking at this notion of an emerging global consensus in two areas at the time. So around gender equality and around the securitization of aid. And arguably, I think, you know, as a good sociologist who wants generalizable work, you could apply that theory and try to test out that sort of model with any range of different aid priorities over time. So whether that's, you know, support to climate change adaptation, or whether that's, you know, even in the way in which donors react to the pandemic and things like that, that process of norm setting or agenda setting, and then how that is instituted within the domestic context and the give and take between that, and how the actual people within these aid agencies mediate that, I think was what I was after in the book. And by the end of it all, I think that I try to demonstrate that there are some of these common processes going on in all of these donor agencies, where you're having the selective uptake of these global agendas, which leads to the appearance of maybe an emerging consensus, but that the implementation of it will maybe vary considerably depending on a range of factors domestically.
For many years, I've been, I think, bugging a lot of our politicians and ambassadors and bureaucrats by saying that a country like Norway, you know, we should be having our own ideas and maybe, you know, suggesting a way forward, some innovative solutions, and not just simply adopting what others are adopting. I got this feeling, and that's why I really liked your book, Liam. I got this feeling, I still keep getting this feeling that, you know, there's this kind of a domino effect that somebody starts something and others follow, as you were saying about Australia, the UK, and Canada in terms of how they're restructuring their aid agencies. It could be whatever is trendy at that moment, you know, some sort of a conceptual framework, be it human rights-based approach or good governance or anti-corruption. I remember there was for a while this concept of recipient responsibility. Mm. You know, you name it. It just, whatever is in vogue, somehow it seeps through. It just filters, or somehow it arrives through different layers. And what I really liked about your book, and you make a very persuasive case that this kind of globalization of aid has taken place through all kinds of levels. But one level is this influence of international conferences, you know, all those things that we attended before the pandemic struck, treaties, hanging out with people, you know, visiting organizations, looking at how one donor is doing certain things, and can we imitate that in our country? So, and I think you do have a very important point there in terms of how this kind of diffusion of aid priorities take place, right? That it is often about, you know, whatever's attractive out there, let's adopt it. And maybe, and I'm just wondering whether you could reflect on that, maybe it is a way of legitimizing one's own activities, one's own generosity, and maybe even in the process, telling countries, you know, other countries, you should be more like us.
I think you hit the nail on the head there, Dan. I think there's definitely that, you know, and I guess, you know, probably all policy arenas are like this in some way, right? That there's, you know, a tendency to follow the trend. And but, you know, in the case of development assistance donors, I think that's exactly it, is this constant shifting target of what the newest vogue is, what the newest trendy approach to things are, that then gets layered on top of all of those pre-existing vogues and priorities and trends. And, you know, I think one of the things that is interesting to me in that respect is that, you know, your donors may always be chasing some new approach or modality or priority,
some new magic bullet
that then, you know, is tried for a while and then maybe eventually falls out of favor, right? So it doesn't take long to go from all the major donors in the world being kind of really wrapped with the idea and the norms of aid effectiveness and the Paris, you know, the at least the Development Assistance Paris Declaration in the early 2000s, to having a lot of that stuff fall by the wayside. You know, here we are, you know, 15 years later, right? And so definitely that part of chasing these common aims and priorities was part of what I want wanted to look at there, right? And to me, and I, you know, when we talked about motivations at the start, part of it, I think, is also about donors seeking legitimacy.
Yeah.
Right. Nobody wants to be viewed as
the odd man out.
Yeah. Donor that is like doing their entirely different thing, or is viewed as backward, or not productive, or not effective. You know, there's always going to be trailing organizations, right? You can't all be a leader, I guess, right? That's one thing. But donors oftentimes seem to aspire to emulate who they perceive as leaders. So that emulation piece was definitely part of what I found in my research, and I still think happens. In Canada, for a long time, there was definitely a desire to always be looking to DFID and see what DFID was doing, looking to the Nordics and see what the Nordics were doing, and aspiring maybe to be more like those donors in some way, because of the view that there was maybe they were leading on certain issues, or leading in certain modalities, or however you see fit. And then I think at the same time within donor agencies, there's also, especially when you have your representatives on the ground in different countries, there is a perception of which donors are more effective, which donors have more influence, which donors are not really worth working with or connecting with or emulating, because they're not on the same track. And when I, as a young development officer, was thinking about these things, it's like, well, trying to tease out like how does what our domestic agenda would seem to suggest for what we want to do here, butt up against kind of these global influences, right? So like you say, the conferences, the treaties, the networks of international actors and things like that. And my feeling when I started writing this was that some of that domestic agenda was really subjugated to trying to buy into this, you know, set of global donor norms or models or institutions or priorities, rather than kind of, like you said, like setting a distinctly, in my case, Canadian course that, you know, would help achieve whatever aims Canada decided it wanted in this regard. And, you know, like you say, with your discussions with the Norwegian ministers and whatnot, you know, yeah, why not go outside the box and do something distinctly Norwegian in this approach, right? And I think that's, you know, maybe it's not a position that many countries can afford to take. And part of that, in my mind at least, is always being worried about justifying or legitimizing the approach that is taken to appease some other audience.
I think that is a great point, Liam, because I was thinking about that right away when you started mentioning this tendency of legitimizing. And I remember this concept of like-minded donors. Mm-hmm. And, you know, in Norway, we tend to compare ourselves with Sweden and Denmark and maybe even the UK. Yep. So it's like, you don't want to stick out. And you're absolutely right. It is also about making sure that you could tell your voters that we are not so different. Everybody else is doing it. So we're jumping on the bandwagon, and thereby it is safer, and thereby it is effective. We are pooling our resources together. There's some sort of a consensus. We finally found the answer. But, you know, I don't want to be too harsh, Liam, to, I suppose, our politicians and our bureaucrats, because we academics also keep changing our minds.
Oh,
and
of course.
We're writing books and, you know, we're saying we were wrong, maybe there is a new way. And so there is always this new idea, new ideas that is being generated. And it's natural that they follow suit. But there's also this political angle, Liam, because we have change in governments, yeah. And every new politician wants to, you know, somehow highlight or figure out one area or a couple of sectors that they want to make an impression. So all of this tension, I suppose, leads to, and I think you also write about it in the book, in terms of Canada, this kind of policy inconsistency that one tends to change course quite often, and that I suppose is pretty inevitable. But I I wanted to ask you also about this other aspect that you study, and I found this to be particularly interesting, is the role of individual agency. Mm. That there are, in addition to all of these conferences and treaties and organizations, you also have champions. You have individuals championing gender or some sector. You have bureaucrats being very entrepreneurial. Mm-hmm. You have this exchange, as you write about, between civil society organizations and the aid agency, or even between academia and aid agencies that we have sometimes in Norway. Sure. A lot of the people working in NORAD have studied at our university, or some of them are my students. So how do you see the impact of individual agency, Liam? Because one of the surprising findings, of course, in your study is that civil society organizations and their lobbying and advocacy hasn't had that kind of effect, at least in your three case studies, but individuals have, right?
To my mind, that was part of what I wanted to look at in the book and in the associated studies, is that as a sociologist who sometimes wears development studies hat and is sometimes engaging with more of the international relations community, there oftentimes seems to be a tendency to just ascribe donor approaches, donor decisions, donor policy and positions to the country, right? Mm-hmm. Canada does this, Norway does that. And when we all know in actual fact that there's an entire micro process going on underneath whatever it is that that national position ends up being. Right? There's somebody writing the memo to the minister. There's somebody representing that organization at some meeting of other donors. There's, you know, somebody tasked with trying to figure out the way that a given organization should speak and act and react on any number of given issues, right? So part of what I wanted to try to get at in the book was to understand some of that sort of more individual agency in that context. And yeah, so the notion of entrepreneurial bureaucrats or champions of certain issues, that's not really new news to anybody that's kind of worked in any sort of organization before. Even in universities, where all of us academics are lucky enough to hang our hats, we see the same sort of thing happen often, right? It really comes down to some combination of getting the right people in the room to do a certain thing, right? And so that came out pretty clearly in the study, especially in the case of the prioritization of women's rights and gender equality in the Canadian and Swedish cases in my book. I think that is quite relevant, especially kind of some of the retrospective stuff on the early development of that. But I do think too that that individual aspect is often overlooked, and we still, you know, think about the formal negotiations that are happening at a DAC meeting or at a UN meeting or any other sort of international venue as being the things that we need to take at face value, when in actual fact, it's kind of like you say, all the sort of micro interactions and relations and everything that's gone on before that, that maybe sets the stage for that more performative, formal, you know, international presence on the global stage. So having been a nobody desk officer who was, you know, putting together all the planning documents and budgets and this, that, and the other, you know, it makes you realize that there are any number of those sorts of people working in this industry across the entire sort of development assistance context globally that are actually driving some of these things. And that exchange piece I thought was quite interesting when I did. I naively went into the study thinking, oh no, there are these very active civil society groups that are going to really shape the way donors think and act on these things. Mm-hmm. And when it came down to talking to bureaucrats and talking to members of these civil society organizations, the common refrain was that formal lobbying or advocacy wasn't perceived as shaping these things in the way that I might have naively thought it would.
Was this also the case in Sweden?
In the Swedish case, there was still that perception at that point in time that the lobbying per se wasn't so much of an issue, but it was, you know, in the Swedish case in particular, very common to have people who were then in Swedish SIDA who had these long histories of working in that civil society context. So it's that personnel exchange that I focus on in the book as being maybe a more subtle way in which that influence is had rather than kind of a formal lobbying piece. And, you know, that may have changed too over the time since I was, you know, conducting these interviews and whatnot in Sweden. But, you know, the Swedish case, at least in contrast to the American and the and Canadian cases at the time, the, you know, Swedish donor had very strong relationship with a quite a small number of very big influential civil society groups in Sweden who are involved in delivering on this development assistance. Whereas the Canadian case, it was many more smaller organizations that were funded by SIDA to do the work. And maybe there is less of a core of influence. So, you know, I think the Swedish case, you might have seen a bit more of that formal influence, but even there I was being told that part of the reasons that we saw Sweden being perceived as this leader on gender equality at the time was that some of the strongest advocates for gender equality within SIDA were former civil society NGO types that had kind of cut their teeth and developed their perspectives and expertise and on this stuff in the NGO world. And so that, you know, interface of people kind of moving in and out of these donor roles, I think was something to focus on that I hadn't come across before at that point in time.
I really did like actually that discussion on how in the book of how major aid agencies came to adopt policies that address issues of women and gender in their programming. And I was thinking, you know, how that is a very good example of how our societies have developed certain values that we have, and we want that to be a part of aid policies. So, and you're right, you know, in terms of this whole thing about gender champions or bureaucratic entrepreneurialism, this could apply, of course, to any other sector in addition to aid. What I quite liked is how you emphasize that not everybody perhaps has that kind of influence. You could also have these so-called guerrilla bureaucrats that go against the kind of general consensus. They're offering maybe a different perspective. And I was thinking that maybe it is all about, you know, getting the timing right, having the right networks. If you're junior, you know, what actually makes you get the minister's ear? You know, what makes you get that attention that others are not getting? So somehow that combination, I suppose, is important, being in the right place at the right time. And maybe, as you were saying about, you know, having others like civil society organizations, it could be a media report somehow boosting or supporting your idea that suddenly gets a lot of attention. And then they are, you know, you are there coming up with this wonderful solution. But just continuing on the civil society point, Liam, you know, for many years I've been really fascinated as to how, at least in, say, Norway and some other countries, certain civil society organizations that tend to, you know, like the major organizations that tend to get a large chunk of the aid budget, their interactions with the aid agency, with the government. And I was, of course, in the first season of the show last year, I had a conversation with Degen Ali, one of these well-known civil society activists. And she has been for many years complaining that civil society organizations in the global south that do most of the work, take most of the risk, often get very little of this of the aid funds, whereas the civil society organizations in rich donor countries get a large chunk. So she thought that is very unfair and that there should be a greater, you know, distribution of resources. So I was wondering if you could reflect a bit on how you see these civil society organizations in Canada or in many other parts or even in the US. is it about the money? And what characterizes their relationship with their own governments? Are they willing to be critical? Or is it more about just saying, yeah, give us the money and, you know, we'll do it. We may criticize you in private, but we won't do it in public.
I think that question raises some, you know, really thorny issues for actors in that space, right? You know, different donor countries have a different degree to which they kind of deliver their assistance through that civil society channel. Obviously, Canada is a country where that's been quite common, and it's, I think, for a long time was viewed as relatively, I don't want to say apolitical, but not heavily politicized, so that NGOs working in that space could work in that space, still be somewhat critical of government or of priorities, and, you know, still survive. And then in the period from about 2006 to 2015, we had a conservative government in power in our country, and there was a really strong association between civil society groups that maybe supported issues or approaches that were viewed as maybe running counter to the priorities of that government, of losing their funding from CETA at the mm-hmm. time. And it really put a chill on advocacy and NGOs speaking out, and some that did really suffered as a result. And so it became much more heavily politicized, but it had a twofold thing. I think it caused some organizations to just really, you know, shut up and not criticize the government because they were worried about their existence, and it
right.
pushed others to be more vocal and more critical. And it actually, in the longer term, has led to a change, because there was a rule in Canada that any organization with charitable status, which a number of these NGOs had, couldn't dedicate more than, I believe it was a 10% of their resources for anything that was deemed advocacy. But the interpretation of that rule in that period came to be viewed as, you know, in very broad terms. So there was an argument at one point that the Canadian Oxfam branches here, and, you know, Oxfam is obviously a global network, but Canada's Oxfam, about whether or not Oxfam advocating for the end of poverty was viewed as political advocacy and therefore would trigger that 10% rule or whatever. And that,
oh really,
you know, yeah. And so, you know, an extremely, you know, almost, you know, insane sort of position, that if you're working to combat poverty, that you're somehow being overtly political. You know, obviously combating poverty is a political thing, but like overtly political in a way that would be viewed as, you know, something that could lose you your charitable status, right? So obviously these organizations walk a fine line, and with the change of government there was a real shift in that approach, but I think people came to realize that something that had been viewed as something, you know, maybe somewhat politically neutral in the past could be quite easily politicized. The second part of your question, though, I think is the other one that is quite interesting to me, because I think that, you know, it's totally a fair criticism about what proportion of development assistance funds that are delivered through NGOs based in the West actually kind of make it into supporting the communities and organizations they partner with in partner countries, right? And if you think through sort of some of the tenets of aid effectiveness, if you want to come at it from more of even a post-development perspective of kind of wanting to support local grassroots activism and movements and things, the argument for why any proportion of development assistance money should really end up in paying experts in the West versus, you know, being used more fruitfully in needy communities and societies is a hard one to sustain. So I, you know, I'm torn about how to think about that, because I know a lot of people that work in that space. I know a lot of people that do good work and help advance thinking and ideas and build relationships and partnerships. But arguably, you know, if you were really wanting to build solidarity and support for local work and activism and priorities on these issues, then doing something where you're directly funding that rather than dealing with an entire series of middlemen, for the lack of a better word, is something that bears more thinking, I guess.
I was thinking that civil society organizations in our parts of the world, it isn't as if they are bad or anything. It is just the question of, you know, how fair the distribution of resources is. And we do need these northern NGOs. They have good ideas. And I think they're also very important to make sure they play a key role, I would suppose, in terms of ensuring that funds are well spent, all of that. And this, in turn, Liam, is important for our politicians, I suppose, because that's one way of saying to the domestic public, look, your tax money is being well spent, you know, and we are making sure of it. And I think politicians also, in terms of this issue we were discussing about how critical can civil society organizations be, I noticed that politicians also tend to heed the advice, even if it is critical, of some CSOs, because then they feel that they can legitimize new initiatives. You know, they could even build on that criticism to launch new initiatives. But we are running out of time. So I just wanted to ask you a final question, Liam. And that really has to do with something that you also address in the book, this sort of a generosity paradox that you characterize, at least the U.S. development assistance to be. But my question is a bit more general. And, you know, as we began this conversation talking about DFID and the UK and how, you know, there are all of these different interests at play, motivations for providing assistance is changing. Even in traditionally generous countries, now there's this more of an inward looking policy. We also have problems, you know, we can't just be generous and stuff like that. So how do you see generosity playing out in the near future? Do you think aid will become more explicitly about promoting self-interest and less about solidarity and altruism?
I do feel like we're in a period where the pendulum of, you know, altruism versus self-interest in terms of what is the dominant narrative around these things is shifting more towards the self-interest, even if it's an enlightened self-interest that a lot of donors kind of claim, right? That, you know, by us helping countries deal with this, that, and the other, it will save us from further spread of disease or, you know, any range of different things that are often parted out and used as justifications for these things. So I do feel like there is that move right now. And then part of that is about domestic political, you know, approaches. So you look at what the Trump administration did to already, I think, what was a less generous American approach to aid. If you look at what the Tories have done in the UK recently, right? The willingness to step back from their 0.7% commitment and the folding of DFID into the Department of Foreign Affairs there. It speaks to kind of a period, I think, of at least more overt sort of alignment of assistance with self-interest. And maybe that goes back to what we were talking about early on, right? If everyone's looking at China and saying, well, look, China's doing it this way and is very clear about the fact that they are making this investment because they want that railway in place so they can, you know, get this resource shipped proper, you know, more effectively and all these sorts of things. Maybe there's more of a willingness in some ways to kind of be overt about that self-interest, which is, you know, maybe if it's being more honest about what's actually going on is not necessarily a bad thing. But then when it translates to arguments then about, you know, what about us first? I think that dynamic seems to be gaining ground in certain countries in the West. I can't speak to everything, obviously, but, you know, definitely that was what was at play in the American context, that, you know, you get that rhetoric here in Canada oftentimes. We have a strange dynamic in Canada where we maybe aspire ideologically to kind of follow Nordic or British sort of past practices around aid and be seen as kind of cutting edge, middle power donor sort of thing. Even Canada's recent feminist international assistance policy does that to some extent. But then we always have the easy comparison to the US and say, well, we give more than them in terms of generosity. So we're all right, even though Canada is abysmal in terms of overall sort of aid to GNI ratios and things like that. So I do feel like we're in a period, and especially with the pandemic, it'll be really interesting to see what happens with overall levels of aid generosity across the spectrum. But I don't think the combination of pulling back on generosity and being willing to accept more naked self-interest is necessarily going to be a positive thing long-term for development assistance as it evolves.
Liam, it was great fun to chat with you today. Thanks so much for coming on my show.
Thanks very much, Dan. I appreciate it and really enjoyed our discussion.
If you enjoyed this podcast, please spread the news among your friends and share it on social media. The Twitter handle for this podcast is GlobalDevPod.
Thank you for listening to In Pursuit of Development with Professor Dan Banik from the University of Oslo's Center for Development and the Environment. Please email your questions, comments, and suggestions to inpursuitofdevelopment@gmail.com.